Dear listener, hi, this is John Dupuy. I want to ask a favor of you. If you like the podcast, Deep Transformation, and you're getting a lot out of it, could you please help us by going to wherever you get your podcast, such as Spotify or Apple or wherever it is, and write a review? That would really help us to get this out. We really believe in what we're doing, and we're really praying and hoping this is helping people and being part of the solution. So if you could do that, it would be greatly appreciated by Roger, myself, and our team. God bless. Thank you.
One of psychology's most exciting discoveries of the last 50 years is that psychological development and maturation can continue far beyond our 20s and reach levels significantly beyond what we've thought of as conventional normality. One of the pioneers doing this mapping is Bina Sharma, who has created what's called a full spectrum map of human development that traces our evolution from childhood into what are traditionally called enlightenment. Listen carefully, since this map is psychoactive, meaning that just learning about it can catalyze your own development and begin to move you into these latest developmental possibilities.
Welcome to Deep Transformation, self, society, spirit, life-enhancing, paradigm-rattling conversations with cutting-edge thinkers, contemplatives, and activists, with Dr. Roger Walsh and John Dupuy. Join us in the evolutionary fast lane as we take a deep dive into transformational practice, peak experience, profound understanding, powerful contribution.
Welcome to Deep Transformation, Self-Society Spirit. I'm Roger Walsh, and our co-host is John Dupuy. And with us today is a person who's been a pioneer in the field of psychological development. In fact, she's a world leader in the field of psychological development. Her name is Bina Sharma, and she plays many roles. She is founder and president of the Vertical Development Academy. She's a consultant to individuals and companies around the world, also a coach to individuals and companies around the world. And she coaches not only how to develop skills, as most people do, but in addition to that, how to foster maturity, how to foster psychological development. I've taken practically every course Bina has offered in the last couple of years, so she's become not only a friend, but also a greatly esteemed teacher, and I have learned a lot from this remarkable woman. She's a very, very effective teacher and coach, and I and many others have benefited from her. And before actually turning to you, Bina, I want to just set a context, because I have actually said on this podcast on, I think, a couple of occasions that to me, the most exciting discovery of psychology in the last 50 years has been that psychological maturation can continue past our 20s. We used to think that the mind more or less stopped developing about the time the body stopped developing. But now it's clear, crucially limpidly clear, that we can mature far beyond what we thought of as the conventional levels of psychological maturity, far beyond what we thought of as normality. And that, to me, just opens extraordinary vistas and possibilities and points us to potentials that are latent within us all and which may be essential for our very survival of our civilization. So we're dealing with an enormously important topic today. You've been a pioneer in this, and I've just had the pleasure of going through my notes that I took, very extensive notes I took in my courses with you. And I thought it might be fun to start at a big picture, because you opened one of your major courses with a statement, with an invitation, actually, to recognize that we are part of an evolving cosmos, and that we, in our dynamic being, our unfolding, are in some way a part and expression of an evolving cosmos, that we too are evolving and developing. So that's a big picture question. Please take it wherever you'd like.
Yeah, well, first of all, I want to thank you. The way you've introduced me is high praise indeed. And I balk at the idea of considering myself a pioneer. I hold a fascination for human development for many, many years. And so I've just followed the breadcrumbs and have arrived at this fascinating field of the continuously evolving human as part of the evolving cosmos. I must say that the highest context I have gotten is from Sri Aurobindo, who is one of the sages of modern India, I would say. So I think I would like to start there, just this idea that man is a transitional being. Nature has been evolving, has evolved man from an earlier consciousness, we might say, animal consciousness. So what is it that makes us assume that we are the end of the ladder or the end of the evolution? So we are being evolved. And nature, so it's nature's secret is the evolutionary process. And the evolutionary stance is not a new stance. And it's also obvious. I mean, even at the very simple practical level, I know I'm not who I was 20 years ago. I have evolved and I will continue to grow. And even when we imagine that there are some people who are not growing or who are stuck, we don't know the ways in which they are shifting, and we don't know the invisible forces that may reveal growth and development. So, yeah, so those are my initial sort of comments, if you will.
Wonderful. And you point to the fact that we're transitional beings and that there is so much more that we, the mystery of who we can become. And actually, I can't resist repeating a wonderful phrase I heard from someone once. They've finally discovered the missing link between apes and civilized humans. It's us.
I love that.
Yes. So your life work has been about exploring psychological development, and in particular, some of what we think of as the farther reaches of human possibilities, and this recognition that we can develop beyond, quotes, health and normality. What does it actually mean for adults to mature? What's that imply?
Yeah, just a great thing to meditate on, right? And a great question. So I want to go back to what you said. It's only in the last 50 years that we are acknowledging and recognizing that adults continue to grow after they have arrived as adults at age 21, when we are pronounced that we are now adults. And I want to say that that is from the point of view of Western psychological science. I would like to put it in that context, because in some ways, there are wisdom traditions of many cultures that point to what it means to evolve, what it means to grow, what it means to be mature. So in the context of Western psychological science, in the context of measuring what maturity is, I would say that that's true. It's only in the last 50 years that we have something that we have identified certain structures of development that we have managed to glean through how language expresses reality, to how people make sense of their world. And we make sense of our world through language. And so when we look at language, we can begin to see what that reveals. When somebody expresses something or says something, we can see what it reveals about how they see the world. And so based on research originally done by Jane Lovinger in the 60s, and then followed up with more extensive research done by Suzanne Cook-Reuter, who's been my mentor, colleague, the farther reaches of development have been in some ways codified based on looking at how people describe their reality through this semi-projective assessment or instrument. It's like a verbal Rorschach. When you look at an image, you make sense of it. So similarly, when you have a sentence prompt, you fill in your understanding of that particular prompt. And when you express yourself, then you reveal the beliefs and assumptions that you hold and how you see reality. So I know it's a little abstract, but it's like, for example, if it would help, an example would be one of the prompts is raising a family. So you might say, someone might say, raising a family is hard. That's it. Nothing else. So there's nothing else that is being revealed about how they see that whole process and phenomenon. Another person might say raising a family is challenging and enjoyable. There's already more that that person is revealing about what they see and how they hold it. And you might go further and hear someone else say, well, raising a family involves paying attention to what is needed in the family system and partnering with your spouse. That is revealing an understanding of a whole system. And further on, someone might say, raising a family means recognizing that I am being raised also. That is now revealing a capacity to see that it is an interdependent, interactive process, and the family is not outside me, something that I am doing something to, but it is also doing something to me. So this is just an example to share how we glean what is the level of perspective a person takes based on how they respond in language to this verbal Rorschach. So that's sort of the origin of looking at development, the capacity to take these levels of perspectives. And when Jane Lovinger did the original research, she saw these patterns. She saw that hundreds of people said exactly the same thing. So they had the same idea about who I am, who you are, what the world is, in exactly the same words. And then she saw that there were others, a whole set of other people, who said something completely different. And then yet another set who said something completely different, but they all shared those worldviews. And so her brilliance was to actually begin to see how these worldviews are a pattern of evolving worldviews, where later worldviews, later ways of making sense of this beautiful life are more enlightened. They are not static. They are more dynamic. They are not outside. They also reveal the internal. They are not looking at one part of the system. They're looking at the whole system. They're not looking at one context. They're looking at multiple contexts. So you see this progression of capacities, and that gives us a fantastic roadmap for us to begin to see what this trajectory is like. This trajectory is being revealed through the stories that people tell. So for me, that is such a gift. And when Lovinger originally did the research, you know, it was forbidden to use that for anything other than research. She was very careful and cautious, and she had a theory that she developed. But the fact that we can actually use it today in ethical and supportive ways to help people get a sense of their own trajectory and what might be next for them is huge. If you look at the transformation industry, the coaching industry, where, you know, we have millions of people learning how to develop themselves and how to develop others, not having this lens, not having the benefit of what this shows us is a big miss in my view. So that's what I've sort of spent 15 years in going a little bit deeper into what does it mean for the human being to evolve. And this is after having spent 10, 15 years on working in organizational systems, learning about large-scale change, but finding that I really need to look at the individual cell, the unit, the individual, because that is, I feel, the source and the root of all the events and all the sense-making.
Yes, and so there's a lot in what you said, and just wanting to unpack some of the key things. As I heard you give a progression of responses to that single sentence, Tim, what struck me was that each progression revealed another facet of insight into the situation or into what a family is. Each was a richer understanding, a more complex, a more nuanced, and potentially more dynamic. So various dimensions of change you are pointing to there as what happens with development, it seemed.
Yeah. And go ahead, John.
Yeah, thanks. As Roger was saying, and you were saying, I think this recognition of developmental stages in humanity is one of the most possibly important things that we can grasp, because there are no problems on the planet right now that face us that don't come from, like your comment you made, Roger, about the evolved human beings and the rest of them. Anyway, and we have Putin right now, who's threatening to use nuclear weapons on other human beings if he feels threatened and doesn't get what he wants. I mean, really? And I looked at my country and I see the things that are going on. And I live in a part of town in a southern state. It's a very nice, safe neighborhood. But right across town, there's really poor and dangerous neighborhoods. And they never seem, it's just generational. They don't seem to be able to get out of, you know, the violence and the drugs and all of these things. So what several questions is what do these higher stages look like? One of the critiques of stage development is that people use it to get on an ego trip. Like, oh, I'm a higher stage than you. You're such a, you know, you're so blue or something like that if you're using the color system. And I think that that probably reflects that the person who's saying it is not actually at the level they think they are, because I think that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems that it would be a growth in empathy and compassion that would grow in the individuals as we move into these higher levels. Is that, that's a question. Is that so? Is that part of these stages of growth? And the other just pressing question, then how do we get there? Because it seems like, you know, we're in one of these movies where the damsel is tied to the train tracks and the train is coming and you know, the royal mountie, is he going to get there in time to save the woman on the tracks, which is us? So we're living in a time where we have the capacity to destroy ourselves completely, and the destruction that's going on the earth, whether it's the environments, the oceans, the air, is coming from us. So at a certain point, if enough of us get to a stage of development where compassion and wisdom increases, we might be able to begin to roll that back. And the idea of using nuclear weapons on people because you don't get the country you want or something like that would go away. So what do these levels look like? Is compassion and understanding a part of this higher development? And how do we practically get there individually and work for our whole human family to make progress in this area?
John, you've given us enough for the rest of the dialogue there. Bina, why don't you pick one of those?
Yeah, I'll just pick a couple. And I'll start with a clean language around how we use the framework. So for one thing, we don't say higher stages and lower stages. We say earlier and later. It's a process in time. It's a process over time. And the word yet is really important in the process of supporting people to use the framework in service of development. So, you know, she, he, they, I are not there yet. So we are, you know, so just creating the space for this is all a process of development. And even the people who sort of misuse the framework and use it to get a sense of security that they know and that they are better, it's part of their learning curve. That's how we learn initially. We grab on to some of the, in a reductionist way, to some of the key elements to learn something. Then we use it in a particular way. And then we realize that our assumptions are challenged. And then we realize, oh, that doesn't work that way. So for example, you might think that somebody at a later stage is this paragon of perfection, and you have the chance to see that they've been measured at a certain stage, so you know that they are at a later stage, and then you discover their feet of clay. You discover that, oh, it's not so simple. They, you know, they actually didn't express their capacity, and they turned out to be just like anybody else. And then there's disappointment and cynicism. But that's the learning process that tells me that my frame and my model of reality doesn't fit what's actually happening. And that is the sort of driver of development, when I realize that what I imagine things are, they are not. And now I come up with a new way of understanding how things are. And we learn this every day. And in some ways, I would say that's one of the definitions of maturity, is you come closer and closer to what is and not what you think it is. And that is in some ways also another way of saying subject becomes object. What you didn't realize that you were subject to, the assumptions you were making, it's now becomes object. You see, oh, that was my sort of filter, or that was my idea about what's going on, but that's actually not what's going on. The simple example I always like, because I've been married more than once, the simple example I like to bring up is, you know, when you first get married, you get into a relationship, you have an idea about what that involves, and you're excited and enthusiastic about it. And then 5 years down the line, you realize, after being challenged, after your assumptions being challenged, you realize, oh my God, I had no idea. This is what it takes to be in a relationship, to be in a marriage, to be a spouse. And 10 years later, it hits you again. I had no idea that this is what it takes. So we come into newer and newer understandings of what is actually happening, what is real, based on reality challenging our assumptions about what is happening. So maybe I went into a different direction, John, but those were a couple of things I wanted to talk about. The assumptions we hold about the model, and then the process of development itself involves challenging our assumptions about how we construct meaning around whatever it is that we are engaging with.
And do you feel that being aware of this model, being aware that we mature into more adequate and more compassionate and perhaps more wiser ways as we get there, do you think the knowledge of the map itself helps people get there in a healthier, probably has maybe more efficient and hopefully quickly? You know, we can save a few lifetimes work if we realize that we're not the top of the food chain. And there's, I think it was a Jewish mystic that once said, it's good to know what's above you. You know, it's good to know that you're not at the end of the road. And knowing this, you think that's a help in itself.
Yes. And I know, Roger, you were going to say something. So would you, I can give a one sentence.
No, why don't you first
one sentence John, yes. Response. So based on my personal experience, I would say yes. Based on what I hear from the people who come into this work that are my colleagues, I would say yes. So based on that, I do believe it's a psychoactive model. And it's a very useful filter that helps me accelerate my development. And I have to be really cautious about using all the lessons that I'm learning about development to apply it so that I'm not making assumptions where they are unwarranted. So it helps me be more vigilant as well.
So beautiful. So what I hear you're responding to John's implication is that an understanding further development is possible. And secondly, having some intimations of what those openings might be is, as to use your word, psychoactive, that has self-catalytic potential for pulling us or opening us to those potentials. And that's a very beautiful thing. Gordon Allport, the great psychologist, said that by their own theories of human nature, psychologists either elevate or degrade that nature. Uplifting theories uplift human beings, degrading assumptions degrade them. And I think what you're offering is a very uplifting perspective on who we not only are, but who we can become.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think it has the potential. So I couldn't guarantee that it would happen every instance, but I think it's a beautiful thing to put into the mix, into the cauldron, you know, into the mystery that makes everything happen. I think it's a very significant element to add. I would also like to highlight that there are ethical ways of using the framework, which I'd like to just a couple of things mention. One is it's only one way of looking at the human being. It's one of 10,000 frameworks in the sense of, you know, infinite. There are infinite ways in which we can look at the human being, this unknowable, mysterious, you know, happening. And this is one great way to look at it. So we have to be really clear that we don't use this framework to fix and to use it in a reductionist way. And that's one of the tragedies, I feel, of what sometimes happened that I have seen happen, that such a liberating framework can be used in a very reductionist way and actually cause harm.
What does that look like when someone uses it in a negative way?
Yeah. So, for example, in a particular group, this was used, the assessment was used, and then people were labeled as being immature or at, you know, lower stages. It was used as a condition to include or exclude people into certain projects. Those are violent ways and harmful ways of using the framework. That's not the purpose of the framework. So that would be one, holding it lightly and to recognize that the framework is an abstraction. It's an idealization. The stages are idealizations. Nobody actually fully inhabits all aspects of a stage. But to begin to see how that universal abstract trajectory, how does that live in you? How does it show up in you, in your particularity, your life experiences? And not to reduce you to a stage. That's the most important piece. Even though we have an assessment and we believe in that assessment, we believe in the science, but we don't use it to fix the person. We use it as an entry point to begin to see what is this revealing about how you typically and automatically tend to hold certain views, anchor in certain ways. What does it tell you about you? Where is your foot nailed to the floor? Where are parts of you still ahead of you? So can you see yourself as this spectrum? And can this framework, some of the specific elements in this framework, help you to identify where you could make a shift? That's very, very useful in comparison to someone who is trying to support you, who doesn't have this developmental framework and is offering ways that you can develop yourself, but is not contextualizing it to capacity, to your level of capability and complexity thinking, you know? So I think maybe 6 out of 10 times, you'd still really be able to support the person, but maybe 4 out of 10, you'd miss the mark. You would end up, because of your own capacity or lack of capacity, you could end up being very much more concrete and linear and goal-oriented than your client who is actually flying higher. And you could do the opposite. You could do the opposite where your client is hungry for more inner work, inner perspective, and you're a coach that is set on setting goals and helping them take the next action. And so I've had so many examples, experiences, and stories from coaches who now realize how they've missed the mark with this additional understanding of this backdrop. So I like to use the framework as a reference point, as a doorway into really honoring and exploring the spectrum that human being is, and then to really honor their unique journey.
Yeah. And I'm aware we're getting into some of the implications of the work and dealing with some of the abstractions and issues that stem from thinking about this. But I'm thinking for people who don't necessarily have a background or understanding of your work and of the larger topic and picture of development, it might be helpful for us to go back a little and just try and give a feel for what actually, more of what happens during development. And I recall in one of the courses you did, you gave a beautiful set of metaphors for what happens with development. You've talked, for example, about the metaphor of growing from a seed into a tree. That was just one of many you gave. And I found that it felt like it gave different facets and perspectives. It's like, oh yeah, this is what's happening. Could you play with some of the metaphors?
Yeah, in that particular instance, we were actually elaborating on the multiple metaphors that could describe the ways of development and that there's not just one. So for example, we could say that the ladder is one metaphor, but the blooming is another metaphor. The flowing of water and carving new ground could be another metaphor. So that context was more expanding the idea of development. And I'd be happy to talk a little bit about the growth through these stages. I do want to address one thing that you had asked, John, about. So how do we get there? So my short answer to that is we don't see vertical development as a goal. We see it as an outcome. Because by setting it as a goal and then trying to get there, there's no guarantee that we would actually get there. But it is an outcome of really investigating our assumptions, of looking at how we are making sense of life and working through the challenges that life is bringing to us as, and all our challenges are our teachers. So what is happening today, you know, the all of the meta crisis, these are the teachers of humanity that's going to challenge us to come up with ways of moving through them. So coming back then to Roger, your question. So what happens in development is you start with basically self-preservation and survival, because, you know, that's the first stage of development or the fundamental stage is where you need to live, you need to exist, you need to survive. And as adults, when we have only that consciousness, then the world is a very threatening place. We see it's a jungle out there and we need to protect ourselves. Everything is seen as an attack. And so it's fundamentally competing and making sure that it's either me or you, and I have to survive. So that's sort of the first level of consciousness. I don't like to use the word consciousness because it's too big a word to be used in this context. So it's the first stage, you would say. At the next level, there is what is, so would you like me to share the names also, or that just?
Sure, you have some nice descriptors of these. And as I recalled you describing the first stage as self-centric, which that says a lot to me.
Yeah, you're centered around the self, yeah. Okay, so, and yeah, we took 2 years to come up with names that were value neutral, that wouldn't prevent people from labeling others. So we're really describing the stage, not the person. We're describing a way of seeing the world.
I just love what you said. Each of these stages is a way of seeing the world and oneself. I mean, there's so much in that state that helps me a lot.
Yeah, thank you. It's a constellation of beliefs and assumptions we have about the world and about ourselves and who we are and what is important, you know, what is the most important thing.
And maybe, as it sounds like you're going to give us the major stages, and perhaps it would be useful for people to have as a context that you've identified, you and your mentor, my mentor too, Suzanne Cook-Reuter, John's mentor too, Suzanne Cook-Reuter, as you've both identified 9 major stages that people go through or adults go through. So, and I love Suzanne's metaphor. She uses 9 levels of increasing embrace,
yes,
which I think is a wonderful metaphor. So,
yes.
So that's the context of what I think you're gonna bring us into.
If you feel that would be helpful.
Oh, that'd be wonderful. Yeah, yeah. And with your key terms that really encapsulate them. Now I know you've spent 2 years coming up with.
I'll try to keep this short. So yes, there are 9 levels and we don't really operationally use the first level because you can't yet function as an independent human being. It's the symbiotic level. So we start with level 2, which is the self-centric. The next level is the group-centric, where the first level, self-centric, is just, this is all about me and centered around the self. The next level is also the socialized stage, if you want to use Keegan's words. Now I realize that I can't just, it's not sustainable. It's not enough for me to all the time just be thinking about myself and grab what I need and not be included in society. So that when you see the limits of that first stage, then you step into the socialized stage where you begin to say, okay, I'm willing to play by the book. I'm willing to follow the rules. And so you want to fit in, you want to be included, you want to belong. There's safety in numbers. So it's not me versus you or them. Now it's us and them. So now you have a bigger boundary, but you can include others. And those others are those that could be my family, my tribe, my faith. It's conforming to a group identity. What's most interesting about this is that in our theory, which is based on ego development theory, so that's also something I'll need to mention sometime, is that there is no sense of self yet in the group-centric identity. There is no separate self. So if you attack my group, you attack me. That's important to know that the psychology is completely identified with the group.
And often though, one of the problems at that level is that if you begin to have a self-identity, you begin to grow beyond the accepted norms of that particular group that you're in, and the group itself will start to attack you.
Yes, that's definitely a dynamic because the group wants to perpetuate itself. The group itself wants to replicate. And of course, again, reminding that nobody is only at one stage. So for example, today, there might be aspects of the group-centric that operate in me in relation to some of my key relationships. For example, I will edit myself when I'm interacting with my 36-year-old daughter. I want to make sure that she approves of me in some ways. And this is because of our history, but we do that. We do that all the time. I got married recently and discovered how much of an idea I had about what it means to be a good wife. And those are the norms that are established and that we follow at the group-centric stage. Of course, because I have later stage capacity, because I'm able to pass through that quickly, but I notice it. I notice it when it comes up. I'm bringing this up so that we don't get caught up in saying that some people are there and I am not there. So there's more subtlety and more complexity in the way this framework, I think, is used and needs to be used. So from that group-centric stage, we then move to the next stage where we separate ourselves from the group. And this is considered the birth of the psychological self, where for the first time, I am not identified by the group. I separate myself and my identity comes from what I do, not what the group expects me to do, not just what the group expects me to do. So what I do means it's again, it's not who I am, but what I do. So it's external, it's my craft, it's my role, it's my job. I'm identified by that. So what that means is if you criticize my work, you criticize me. There's no separation between what I do. My identity is defined by that. It's also, that stage is also called craft logic. And this is a significant stage because we all work in the world and we are paid for the work that we do. So we have a lot of our identity defined by that which we are paid for. So all the technology professions are vulnerable to this stage of development. So, you know, the doctors, the lawyers, the technocrats, they tend to get stuck here because it's how they identify themselves, how they define themselves.
And very highly rewarded.
And rewarded, yeah. And then there's also conformity at this stage, but then you conform not to your group, but you conform to the specialist group, you know, to the professor in Harvard or the teacher that taught you. And it doesn't matter. It could be even a spiritual tradition. And you could be at this craft logic stage in connection with spirituality as well. So you can see this gets quickly even more complex. But it's a definable stage. That's interesting. It's definable. You can see the anchors. You can see the beliefs that keep people there.
So just to summarize, so you started with the self-centric, where the center of the world is myself and my preservation.
Safety. It's, yeah, safety. Yeah.
And then you pointed to the possibility of expansion, where the center of gravity now becomes the group, my tribe. Now you're pointing to a differentiation from that to an identity around my skill, what I can do, what I'm capable of. So I just wanted to point to the progression here. So it's beautiful. Yeah, please keep going.
Yeah, and we're always pursuing self-worth and self-value. So whatever gives us value, we want more of that. So the tendency is to get more, to be more and more entrenched in that worldview because your sense of self comes from there. So to break out of one worldview and to be able to step into the next is huge. It's a phenomenal achievement. And we recognize that at all the earlier stages as well. So when we have clients who are at these quote unquote earlier stages, it's a triumph and it's a celebration for them to begin to challenge one or two assumptions about conforming to their boss or not having a voice, even though they may have other capacities. But those kinds of shifts are what I think are really contributing to development in the workplace, I would say.
I just want to note again what you said there, because I noticed an inner response in me to hear you describe each new stage as a triumph, something to be celebrated. It implies that this is a heroic quest to mature.
It is.
Beautiful. Thank you.
And it's beautiful. And I mean, this is, you know, it's such learning for me because when I came into adult development, and of course, you know, we glorify the later stages and we pay more attention to later stages and we think we have to get away from the earlier stages. So for me, one of the discoveries has been to love and appreciate people wherever they are. And initially, I would balk at the idea of coaching somebody who tested at this skill-centric stage. I would think, oh, they are so stuck, and how am I going to help them? And I would much rather work with somebody who's way ahead and who already has capacity and who's able to reflect. But I've found that I'm, over time, I just love working with individuals, even at earlier stages, and to recognize in some ways that the earlier the stage, the greater the gift. Mm. And in some ways, the later the stage, the greater the promise. Because at later stages, you have more capacity. You can do so much more. With just one session with you, you will get enough to, you'll be on your own for a year. You can work on all the assumptions. You can reflect. You can get feedback. You can begin to transform yourself. So there's so much more promise because you have so much more capacity. But earlier the stage, because they are so fundamental, those assumptions, the gift is greater. If you can break one or two of those stage-related anchors or footholds, as I call it, that's liberation that can just bring great dividends.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Are there not negative aspects of each of these levels? And you know, I use developmentalism in my work with drug addicts for years. It weren't pretty. The people that I was working with for many years were people in late-stage addiction. And one of the things that I noticed using this kind of developmental perspective is that before they started taking drugs, they were at a certain level of development. You know, they cared about their family, they cared about their dog, going to school, you know, being a responsible something at some level. And then when the addiction grew, their developmental stage went down, down, down until the later stages, they're sociopathic. They're willing to do whatever they have to do to supply the drugs, okay, that they're addicted to. And they will steal, they will rob, they will be violent, they'll sell their bodies, they'll sell other people's bodies. I mean, all of this stuff that would have been completely repugnant to them before, when the trance of addiction got that heavy, you found it there. And so when I was working with these people, I would hold up the mirror. And this is, you know, they're off drugs at this point. They're going through the process of becoming more themselves or more human again. And they would begin to feel great shame and regret at some of the things they had done, and realizing that the person they used to be had gotten lost in this, and they were behaving in a way that was very primitive and very hurtful. And just as in children, early on, after, you know, you've gone through early childhood, you become very identified with your family. Right. And that's who you are, your mom, your dad, your brothers and sisters. Then you move on to adolescenthood, which is lots of fun, as we all know. But it becomes very important. You find your group of your peers that you identify with. And it's really important that teenagers find peer groups that are healthy enough to help them stay within that level of development and prepare them for a more mature adults, you know, going to college and this and that. And you find that, you know, some people never seem to get out of that adolescent. And I struggled when I was an adolescent. You know, some were doing drugs, some were athletes, some were nerds and all this. And I was kind of a bit of all of that and finding my identity there. And I've noticed that I've worked with a lot of teenagers over the years that whatever group you conform to is really, really important. And it is really hazardous and challenging. And yeah, I'm, you know, it's a real issue. So it's not every group is good. Let's say that. And you need to conform to a group that's good enough so that you can be there and move through that and mature into the version of yourself that you were born to be.
Yeah. So you started by saying, aren't some things negative in the earlier stages? So I don't see them as negative. I just see them as limitations. So here is where the other work that I do in polarities, which we won't go into detail here, it sort of comes into play. So it's not that they are so extremely self-focused that it's negative, that it's bad. It's they don't have the capacity to include the other. They don't have the capacity to embrace what is out, what is excluded. So it's a lack of capacity and not so much that it's negative. So that would be the way I would say it. And the second piece around some groups are bad, and it's really important which groups you are. That's only one part of it, I feel. If you're talking about children and, you know, adolescents, then parenting is an important component of that. It's because we know people who've been parented so well that they navigate, they are more discerning because of the guidance that they have and other things in their environment. So sometimes, I mean, more and more I'm thinking, especially as I think about the meta crisis and the crisis in education, I think there's a crisis in parenting, which not many people are talking about. And if I take it further, I think there's a crisis in grandparenting because the social fabric is breaking down. I'm a grandparent now, and I'm beginning to think, who do I want to be as a grandparent? And how do I support, how do I parent my adult child or adult children with my, you know, with my husband, we also have other children. How do we parent adult children? And then if I take it further, it's also a crisis in ancestoring. You know, what kind of how do I become an ancestor? What does it mean for me? You know, you may have heard this quote that I was so struck by it. Every time an old person dies, a library burns.
Wow.
I don't know who said it, but that has just stayed with me, you know? And so how are we looking at parents, grandparents, and living ancestors? We probably went off somewhere, but I wanted to say it's not just about the groups. It's also about the system, the context, the culture, the parent. I mean, there's so many elements. Everything you open up is connected to everything else in a way. So
yeah, and we've got a lot of different threads we could follow, but we're on a primary thread here of you showing the unfolding of development. So we've gone through the self-centric, the group-centric, the skill-centric. What's next?
Yeah, the next is truly becoming independent, not conforming even to those that are in my craft world or who are in the kind of roles I play in the world, but truly having a sense of self-authorship. So it's self-authoring. We call it the self-determining, where I finally see myself as an independent, sovereign entity that I can think for myself and I can do what I want and I can come up with my own beliefs and I can change my beliefs. It's again, it's a huge leap from the previous stage. And I can be the master of my destiny, the captain of my ship. I can change the world. I can change myself. There's a lot of energy and a belief in predictability, making things happen, and an objectivity that is truly healing. Because for the first time, I can, like in the previous stage, I was saying skill-centric stage, you criticize me, you criticize my work, you criticize me. You criticize who I am as a worker or as a father. And you're criticizing me. You might be criticizing how I am as a father, but I take it personally. At this self-determining stage, for the first time, there's that separation, that objectivity. I can stand outside myself. And when you give me feedback or you are critical of me, I can actually look you in the eye and say, you know what, you're right. I could have done that differently and I did not see that coming. Or there's a willingness to see that because there's that separation and I become somebody that I can work on. Whereas in the previous stage, I'm working on everybody else.
Right. Well, so much easier to fix other people than oneself. And you implied a kind of capacity for self-reflection at this stage. And I recall that you've talked about the birthing of the kind of interior world or the capacity for introspection and self-reflection. Is this coming online now?
Or? Yeah, it is. The nature of what the reflection is about changes. So at the previous stage, at the skill-centric stage, they're not really capable of reflecting in terms of a self-awareness, but they are curious about themselves. So they like to see, what type am I? What are my strengths? What are my weaknesses? In some ways, you could say that's reflection, but in other ways, it's not a capacity for deep reflection. It's still trying to define things and giving it quantitative measures. And at this stage, you really like to say, I'm an 8 in the Enneagram, or I'm an INTJ on the MBTI, and like to take, you know, popular psychology tests and then share it on Facebook and say, I am this, what are you? So that's the first level of becoming, of even identifying who you are. And even that's a good step from the previous stage, you know. So at that self, at the next self-determining stage, there's more reflection. There's more awareness of how I tend to, that I can make mistakes, I can learn. And once I start, once I'm a little aware of that happening in me, then I can be kinder to other people. And I can also, you know, forgive your mistakes, or I can say, no, we can learn. Let's learn, you know, we can do this. We come up with models for measuring and learning from our mistakes. We can do plan, do, check, act. We can have learning cycles. So there's a lot more complexity and capacity. We're more interested now in process, not just in perfecting something, but in learning about how to perfect something and learning about how to learn and then teaching others and teaching ourselves and not just becoming a better professional, but I want to be a better husband also. I want to be a better parent or a better spouse. So that it's almost like multiplied agentic, you know, focus on changing and making things happen. But I am the agent. I am independent. I am separate. And if there are differences between you and me, my approach is, well, let's put it on the table and discuss it. And if we can come to an agreement, great. If not, let's agree to disagree. It's sort of objective, logical. And underneath that, there is a view that even though you have a different opinion, I can accept it, I can work with it, I can agree to disagree with you, but basically what I think is right, because I'm going to stick to my beliefs. I might, of course, be influenced, etc., but my sense of self comes from being clear about what I think is right and what I think is wrong. And I can, at this time, I could even, you know, change my religion, because I choose my religion. I'm now into all kinds of isms. I will follow other systems and choose. So choice is really important. Sovereign, independent choice is important.
And this, what do you call this? This particular,
this is the stage? Self-determining. I determine everything.
And is this stage three? I'm trying to kind of track these things as we go.
This is four.
Four, okay.
Yeah, I mean, this is actually five because we are not including the very first. So we use eight that are the operational sort of workable stages in our work, yeah.
And to put this in a context, you also divide, you've got your nine, but actually for adults, eight different levels of increasing embrace, to use that wonderful metaphor.
Yes.
And you've just taken us through the first four. And as I recall, you also divide these eight levels into bands and saying, this is effectively, we've been working with the pre-conventional and conventional bands of development, right?
Yeah, thank you, yeah, for bringing that up. So that first stage, that's self-centric, where you're only concerned about your survival and your world is very small and you just don't have a larger context. You can't align with anything larger than yourself. That is called pre-conventional. So that's the band, which is you're not yet socialized into society. You can be on the fringes of society. And of course, a lot of people can still be anchored at this stage and do very well in society because they have access to the next two or three stages. So remember, we had talked about nobody is at one stage only, but you have, of course, a lot of people who are primarily rooted in this stage. So the next three stages that we talked about are called the conventional stages. And at the end of that self-determining stage, we then move into what is called post-conventional. But here, I would like to bring in what I talked about, the ego development theory, which is at the heart of this framework.
Bina, can I provide some context
yes,
here
please.
And say that,
please.
You know, one of the exciting things in this whole research field is that developmentalists have identified ways and a variety of capacities that can mature from emotions to motives to values to cognitive capacities to, in your case, ego development or meaning making. So you're focusing on one particular aspect of development, but a very central one, the very who and what we experience ourselves to be and the way in which we make sense of our world. So this is your particular focus, as I understand it.
Yes, thank you. And it is Jane Lovinger's original construct of the ego then that has been refined and further developed by Suzanne. So So the ego is the core construct that underlies this theory. And so what do we mean by ego? Because as I like to say, ego is a very big word, and there are so many associations from different disciplines, you know, philosophy and theology and spirituality and divinity and all kinds of fields have this, and of course, depth psychology as well, have used the word ego. And then we use it very loosely in popular, you know, in popular use, in popular culture. So in this framework, the ego is that part of ourselves that's trying to make sense of the world. It's that part of ourselves that's trying to come up with a story so that we can feel oriented. So it's also in evolutionary psychology, it's called the orientation reflex. It's just like you have a physiological reflex when, you know, you go and the doctor taps your knee and your knee, you know, has the reflex and things are going well. The psychological reflex is we have life experiences, and then we want to orient ourselves to what does this life experience mean? And if we can't make sense of it, that's disorienting. And so we are always orienting ourselves to making sense and making meaning. And that part of ourselves that is doing that, that process of digesting life experience, that is the ego process we're trying to understand. And then we tell a story. So the output of that is a representational story or a map. And that map evolves and changes. So this developmental process, we say, is the ego's evolution process. And what that does is it, in some ways, rehabilitates the ego as a vital and necessary part of human meaning making.
Can I point to something here you've just said, Bina, because it gave a little light or flash of illumination for me. It's a, you implied that at each subsequent stage, the ego creates a more comprehensive, nuanced, meaningful, significant map to understand ourselves and the world.
Yes, yes.
Beautiful, yeah. Stay tuned for part two of this dialogue with Bina Sharma, in which we explore the post-conventional stages of maturity, in which people grow beyond normal limits and develop rare capacities of more deeply and fully understanding both the world and themselves.
Today's episode was brought to you by iAwake Technologies. Visit the Deep Transformation website to find out more about iAwake's audio tools designed to wake us up, grow us up as a part of our daily deep transformational practice. Thank you for joining us. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the Deep Transformation podcast, and we greatly appreciate your comments, suggestions, and questions. Thank you for all you are and all you do. From John, Roger, and the Deep Transformation team.